This podcast is intended for educational and informational purposes only and does not replace independent professional judgment. Land Gorilla Inc. makes no representations, warranties, or promises for and disclaims any express or implied warranties related to content. Before acting on any information, you should consider the appropriateness of the information as it pertains to your unique business needs. Hello, and thank you for tuning in. My name is Jamie Lee, and this is the Construction Lending Podcast, where we are sharing information, trends, and best practices around all things related to construction financing. Today's topic is the USDA Single Family Housing Guaranteed Loan. According to findings from the National Association of Home Builders Home Building Geography Index, the largest growth in single-family market share came in rural markets, rising from 9.4% in the fourth quarter of 2019 to a share of 11.8% in the fourth quarter of 2022. Joining us today is Ed Peace, Finance and Loan Analyst at the USDA, and Shannon Ferris, Director of Strategic Relations at Land Gorilla. Thank you both for being here. Before we get started with our questions, I'm going to turn it over to Shannon to share why mortgage lenders should get excited about the USDA's Single Family Housing Guaranteed Loan. Shannon, over to you.
Hey, thank you for having us here today. I just wanted to share with everyone the issue that we commonly see with our lender clients, and that is that they're all looking for new sources of loan production that are purchase-centric loan products. Construction lending certainly falls into that bucket, and we're seeing many, many lenders standing up a construction-to-perm program for the first time. And for me, it's particularly exciting to see the USDA launching their securitizable construction to perm loan program, because it does provide a solution to lenders regarding issues like profitability, gain on sale, market share. Profit margins, of course, are on everyone's mind. And anytime you're able to originate a loan that can be sold immediately, you know, that has a very big impact on the loan production and profitability of a company. And in this case, Ed's going to spend some time talking to you and explaining to you the different versions of construction to perm loans at USDA. And I know that he's going to spend some time talking about the Ginnie Mae securitizable construction to perm program, which allows the lender to sell the loan before the house has been built, which is very unique to be able to book that profitability and that gain on sale of the loan once it's gotten into a mortgage-backed security like a Ginnie Mae. And so that, for me, is very exciting. I know it's generating a lot of interest from lenders, and that's one of the reasons that we've asked Ed to join us on this call.
Thank you, Shannon, for sharing those insights. I know that I have joined you in a few events, and when you have brought up the USDA, it was like everybody just had questions and their ears perked. So let's get right into the topic, as there are a lot to cover. Ed, we're so glad you could join us today. Please tell us a little bit about your background and how you got started with the USDA.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jamie Lee. Always glad to be a part of an event like this podcast, and always excited to share information about our USDA rural development mortgage programs. So a little about me. I grew up on a farm in Georgia, and having a degree in ag economics, I was able to start with USDA rural development in 1989, all the way back to 89. It was called Farmers Home Administration back then, in a local office in Georgia, and moved around several different offices. My duties back then were loan origination, underwriting, appraising, inspections for new construction and repairs, loan servicing, and was able to work my way to the state office as guaranteed loan coordinator. So I was kind of the point of contact for all lenders for the program when it came out. I was at that point of contact in 91, but I became the contact after 1998. and then eventually to single family housing program director for 12 years.
Wow.
As program director, I was overseeing all single family housing operations in Georgia. And now I'm happily able to serve on the national office staff on what we call the lender and partner activities branch. Our main activities are training and education and outreach for our programs. And so that's a little about me.
You have some great experience, Ed, and you are no stranger to the USDA. Before we get into the specifics of the loan program, let's take a step back and address the statistics. Like, what is causing the shift with families moving away from the city and into rural markets? I mean, is this a trend that you think that will continue?
Yeah, that's a great question. And when I first saw those statistics, it kind of opened my eyes a little bit. And, you know, probably the biggest factor is how the COVID-19 pandemic shifted employers' working models away from the traditional way of people having to live in the same town that you work in, and how telework or remote working has kind of, you know, decoupled where people can live in relation to where they work. So out in rural areas, people have more, you know, elbow room, less traffic, possibly safer environments for themselves and their families. And probably one of the biggest things is more home for less money, that bang for the buck in the rural areas versus the more suburban or urban areas. And especially when faced with, you know, record inflation like we've been seeing the last few years, people are looking for the ability to afford a home at all. And the lower cost of homes in rural areas has contributed greatly to this shift, I believe. So, yeah, all these factors kind of line up to cause this shift in growth in rural areas. I do believe that as long as, you know, employers allow their employees to work remotely, I do think this trend will continue. So, yeah, that's a great point.
Right. And I'm sure as you were listing out those reasons why this shift is happening, our listeners' ears perked up, because I know even for myself, I'm in that state in which, you know, teleworking, like you mentioned, plays a big role in being able to have that flexibility to move where you would like, but sure, still be able to keep your employment. But let me ask you, Ed, like, what is considered as a rural area?
Yeah, great question. So the easy answer is any town with a population of 35,000 or less residents. And that's defined by the census, U.S. census every 10 years. And so it's interesting that we're talking about that, because this is one of the years that we're actually reviewing, going through that that 5-year review. So we're required to review our rural urban lines every 5 years. And immediately after the census information is released, which we're working on the 2020 census, and it takes a while for that information to get to us, but that's what we're working on now, to see if those urban lines have grown out any more from the urban centers or if they've shrunk some. Typically, they grow outward because, you know, trends over the last decades, except for what we just talked about, you know, the urban areas typically tend to expand. And so we're going through that review right now nationwide and probably go live with those maps on October the 1st. So with any changes.
With, you mentioned that the urban areas can expand. With this shift that we're discussing, can rural areas begin to dwindle down and turn into an urban area?
That's a great question also. So the answer is yes. It does happen some, and quite a bit in some areas. Naturally, developers' interests peak, you know, when they learn about our program and that it's available in the rural areas. And so they start to build in those rural areas, especially if they adjoin a faster growing area, you know. So that kind of spillover from the urban growth into what is now still rural causes that rural area to grow. And if it grows to the point of not being able to distinguish between the urban area and the old rural area, you know, that line is then moved outward and that rural area does shrink a little bit. So, you know, it sounds like a bad thing, but in a way, it's our program is doing what it's designed to do. So it can be considered a good thing in that we're helping those in those areas, you know, get into home ownership.
You brought up your loan program that is helpful in creating urban areas and, you know, getting people into homes. Now, tell us, what is the USDA single family housing guaranteed loan?
How much time do we have? So, you know, let me start out by saying at this point, it's very important to differentiate and state the fact that USDA has two very different and distinct housing programs. The first one is called the Section 502 Direct Program, and it was established in 1949 by Congress under the Housing Act of 1949. And that program is administered totally by USDA employees to what we consider low-income families and individuals. That's folks that are 80% or below of moderate of the area median income. And so that program carries subsidy with it, where the agency and taxpayers help make those mortgage payments if the people qualify for subsidy. So that's very different than our guaranteed loans that we're mainly here to talk about today. So the guaranteed program, it was brought about in 1991, kind of as an expansion of the Housing Act of 1949. And it allows for people of what's considered moderate income versus the low, but moderate income individuals and families to obtain a loan through a bank or mortgage company. And then USDA, as that bank or mortgage company is originating and underwriting that loan, you know, submits it to USDA, and we put a guarantee on that loan to say that if that lender ever has to liquidate that loan, heaven forbid, that USDA will basically reimburse them for any loss that they suffer on that loan. So again, it's the bank or mortgage company or credit union that's making these loans, and we back it with a 90% guarantee. Wow. So that's 90% of the original loan amount. So yeah, what's not to love about that, right?
I was just going to say, it sounds a little too good to be true, Ed. Yeah.
So all of our USDA mortgage programs, be it whether it's the direct program or the guaranteed program, they have no down payment requirement. So it's 100% loan to value up to the appraised value. Okay. And with that federal government backing. So we can allow financing of 100% of the appraised value, like I mentioned. As a matter of fact, we do require a 1% upfront guarantee fee with every loan that we close. And that fee can always be financed into the loan. So, and that's regardless of the appraised value. So actually it's a 101% loan to value loan. And so that fee that's paid by every person that gets a guaranteed loan, that's what runs the program. That money's kind of put into a pot of money, and any losses that the agency pays in the program comes from that pot of money. So it's very favored program on Capitol Hill because it doesn't take taxpayers' money to run it. And so speaking more about, you know, who we're talking about, let's look at the applicants a little bit, and keep in mind that we do have maximum household income limits. Again, that's 115% of area median income. But that's pretty liberal because it includes a lot of families and individuals. Every state has different income limits, but the lowest of the maximum published limits is $103,000 for a household of one to four people. So if you have an individual that's making $100,000 or even $103,000, they could qualify income-wise, you know, as far as being under the limits. Households of five or more people, it's $136,000 maximum income for the household. And the fact that we have to abide by income limits, that was established by Congress in that Housing Act of 1949. So, and again, in 91, we added the guaranteed loans. So as part of the law, it's the other part of that law is that the property has to be in that rural area that we talked about. So that's the two major components, and those are considered statutory requirements. In other words, you know, spelled out by the statute or the law. that would have to meet income limits, and the property has to be in a rural area. And we talk about rural areas and, you know, the fact that it's 35,000 or less in population, but really and truly, when you look at the maps of the rural areas, the vast majority of the country is a rural area. It's over 90% of the landmass in the United States that falls under USDA's definition of rural. So we can go far and wide on our programs. So
that's an interesting statistic, because I think when we think about urban areas or we think about North America, we focus on those urban areas where we think, hey, the majority of America is urban areas. And right. I'm glad that you pointed that out.
Yeah. And another statistic, I believe by the census, is that 4 out of 5 households in the country fall under the 115% of median income. So they fall under our income limit. So again, that's so those are limitations, but they're not very restrictive, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's what we like to say. But getting back to the applicant, as far as their credit requirements, credit histories go, it's pretty generous, actually. USDA, we don't have any particular credit score that they have to meet. So we rely on the lender's credit requirements and their secondary market credit overlays. So, you know, basically they're underwriting by their underwriting standards, not USDA's particularly in as far as the credit goes. And when it comes to repayment ratios, the typical front end and back end of 29 and 41, that's kind of our starting point as far as the maximum ratios go. Our GUS system, that's the guaranteed underwriting system, it's an automated underwriting system. It's pretty generous, and it looks at strengths and weaknesses and the stability of the applicant situation before rendering an underwriting recommendation. So we can go, you know, a lot of loans that receive an accept recommendation are actually above the 29-41 ratios. So it looks at algorithms that try to make it make sense to say, hey, you know, if you're real strong in all areas, all other areas of underwriting, then we should be able to, you know, allow it a little bit higher ratios there. So, and GUS, the automation of GUS, you know, was able to bring consistency into the program. So you said a lot of lenders were very interested in about the single close construction or the construction to perm loans that we have to offer. So we find a lot of interest in that program as well. So that's where the loan closing can cover both the construction financing as well as the permanent loan. It's all rolled into one loan closing. And of course, that saves the applicant time and money because they no longer have to secure a temporary construction loan and then later have to refinance the short-term financing with a permanent mortgage. It's all rolled into one loan closing. So that saves them on, you know, closing costs. They don't have to close two different loans and, you know, take off work to attend two different loan closings. So very convenient for the applicant themselves. And within that loan feature, the applicants have the option of establishing reserve accounts from loan funds for either the interest-only payments that would have been made during construction, or they can opt to establish a PITI, payment reserve, in order to make the principal, interest, taxes, and insurance payments that are due during construction. And by doing that, the borrower isn't having to make rent payments plus the new house payment while they're building the house. So that helps them out a lot there too.
Ed, can you comment on the difference between the interest-only version versus the PITI version, one being securitizable immediately, the other being securitizable at completion. Could you draw the distinction between the two of those?
Sure can. So yeah, the, you know, what everybody usually thinks of is the interest-only. That's like what's been done conventionally for forever, where only the interest that's accruing on the funds as they're drawn down, as the construction draws are made, interest accrues on that advance, that total advance. And so with that, any interest that's accruing during the construction period, you know, the applicant has the, or by that time it's a borrower, they have the option to pay those payments either out of pocket if they have the, you know, the personal funds to do so, or out of this payment reserve to make the interest payments out of from loan funds. And so in that product, at the end of construction, the lender would then reamortize the loan and establish a permanent long-term payment and after that reamortization. So so compare that to the securitizable version. So the securitizable version is where the PITI payments are established and start from within 60 days of the loan closing. And so the secondary market would look at that as being, you know, as a closed loan with payments already being made on it with a mortgage on the property. And so they consider that a fully securitized loan, even though the property has not yet been built and payments are being made on that. So it's an income generating product for them. So at the end of construction on that type of loan, there's no need to reamortize that loan. So payments just continue to be, you know, continue being made, and the loan, you know, the construction part is closed out. The inspections, final inspection has been made, and the borrower just takes over those payments if they're being made out of the reserve account, or if they have been making some of those payments themselves, they just continue right on to make those payments as a permanent loan. So does that answer the question there?
Yes, sir, it does. And, you know, another question that we get very often is whether or not the borrower has to use a licensed general contractor to build a house, or whether or not the borrower can be an owner builder and build their own home.
Right. So the answer to that is that owner builders are not eligible for this type of financing under our guaranteed loan. So they do have to use a third party general contractor.
Okay.
The licensing aspect is only if that state that the property is located in and the contractor is located in requires a license. So
does the lender have to vet out the contractor, the builder?
Yes. Yes, okay. They do. They have to make sure that the lender has at least that the builder has at least 2 years history in single family housing construction, not just, you know, a repair contractor trying to get started in building. They have to have 2 years experience in completing a whole single family, you know, home in the construction process.
Does the contractor have to provide financial statements to be vetted out? I mean, you know, 2 years of tax returns, is that part of the vetting process required by USDA?
USDA does not specify that. We leave that up to the lender's prudent, prudent lending practices. So if that's part of their, normal vetting process, then that's what would take place. We don't specify that they have to go through those steps.
Those are great questions. And I think these are questions that our listeners want to hear. Ed, you have presented the guaranteed loan so beneficial to the borrowers or the potential homeowners. Now, let's dial it back to the mortgage lenders. What benefits will they have being able to offer these guaranteed loans?
Yes. Yeah, so they can increase their client base by offering a no down payment program with the lowest out-of-pocket costs and the lowest monthly costs, along with the government backing. So again, yeah, kind of say what's not to love about it. So,
right. Do they have a separate approval process as a mortgage lender to be able to begin offering the guaranteed loan?
Yes. If they're going to seek underwriting approval, where they're actually underwriting the loan, they do have a separate approval process. If they're underwriting or servicing loans. So, but in all cases, the lender's principal officers have to have 2 years experience in making or servicing guaranteed mortgage loans. And if they're already approved with another recognized source, such as government entities like Fannie, Freddie, Ginnie, HUD, or VA, or their state's housing finance agency, They can usually be approved with USDA. So the flip side of that is they, if they don't have one of these approvals, there's a way to get approved if they can prove demonstrated ability to underwrite sound loans.
Mm-hmm.
So, but now if a lender is approved as a correspondent type lender with one of our USDA approved lenders, that other lender does not have to seek USDA approval, and they can act as a third party originator with them without having to get USDA approval. So, and to qualify or to say qualify, but to participate in the single close construction loan feature,
mm-hmm.
USDA approved lenders do not have to seek separate approval to participate in that. So by submitting that type of loan for USDA review and approval, lenders are then certifying that they have at least 2 years experience in construction lending, or that they are employing the services of a third-party construction management company, such as Land Gorilla or a similar company. So they can meet that requirement that way.
And that's a great point that you made. I'm going to shift the questions to specific loan-specific questions that we have heard when other events, when we've brought up USDA. Does the USDA require a fixed price construction contract?
Yes. We can do contingencies with that fixed price, but it is still considered a fixed price contract. So no, cost plus type contracts. It does need to be a fixed price contract.
And then if the loan has to be completed within 12 months, do you guys have an extension policy if the home isn't completed on time?
Yeah, if the home isn't completed within 12 months. So, yeah, the lender should require to have a contract extension request, completed by the applicant and the contractor to specify the new date of completion. USDA does not dictate the 12 months, except for the fact that we can only include 12 months into the payment reserves from loan funds. So if the time period extends past what the borrower has borrowed for payment reserves, then either them or the builder would have to, somebody's going to have to make those payments if they go beyond what the loan has allowed for in those payment reserves. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, it does. Okay. Now, I'm sure you've seen, individuals, homeowners, potential homeowners, they're getting unique with the type of properties they're looking to build. And yeah. I think you're catching my drift on this. Yeah. Are there any property types that are excluded from this program?
Yeah, there are. Any property that has an income producing feature and any property that's in the urban area, those are not eligible for this program. So you have to be careful about income producing features. Now, if it's on a very small scale, basis, like a home craft, business or, a haircutting business out of the home, something like that, it's just a property that doesn't have commercial features, and it's not what the regulation says is not principally designed for income producing. So we can actually do, existing site-built homes. We can do new construction site-built homes, as mentioned. All of those are eligible. So are brand new manufactured homes. And even in some states, we have a pilot going on right now to see if we're going to make this permanent, to see if we can do existing manufactured homes that are built after 2006. Yeah, that's kind of new to us. We can allow condominiums, as long as they meet HUD, VA, or Fannie and Freddie requirements. Even special dwelling types like geodesic dome homes and barn dominiums are eligible and acceptable. As long as there's not any type of income producing feature for that, because barn dominiums sometimes, if you look up the definition of that, a lot of times the barn underneath the dwelling could very well be, income producing. But if it's just a style of barn dominium and not an actual active barn dominium where they're running a cattle operation or a horse operation out of it, could very well be acceptable. So we can even go as far as tiny homes. We've had some questions about those over the years. They can also be considered acceptable as long as they're not a manufactured home that's under 400 square feet. We do specify that. And they meet either the HUD handbook 4000.1 as determined by the appraiser or inspector, and that would be for existing homes, or as long as they meet the building code for brand new construction, we can accept them. So we do defer to either that HUD handbook 4000.1 for existing homes or for the building code for new construction.
And thank you for pointing and specifically mentioning those types of properties, because I know that we've had some questions surrounding barn dominiums and tiny homes. So thank you so much for pointing that out.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to mention that I might have forgotten, in-ground swimming pools. I know in the past we have been somewhat restrictive on in-ground swimming pools on even existing properties. That restriction has been lifted. So we're okay with in-ground swimming pools, hot tubs, and saunas on existing properties. We still want to be able to include them in funding on new construction, but we can do them across the board on existing properties. So that was a question we used to have a lot as well.
Great. So it seems that, you know, there's some flexibility with the types of property. Are there any limitations to a max acre limit or a max house size as a percentage of value limit?
No to both. The lot size just needs to be typical for the area for residential purposes. And the appraiser is the one to supply that information to the lender who makes the decision. But and USDA no longer has a limit of the percentage of value that the lot can have as compared to the total combined cost of the lot and home. We used to have a limitation on that, but that's also been lifted. So there's not a limit on either one of those.
Well, this loan program, I'm going to run and try and get myself into to be able to be to get a guaranteed loan myself here.
Can I interrupt you right there and say that in 1994, my wife and I built a home in North Georgia through this very program. And, you know, I was the one out there trying to help get the program off the ground and market it to local lenders. And I'd come home at night to our little apartment and think, well, gosh, you know, I'm describing myself. I had a stable job. I had decent credit. I just didn't have money for down payment. And I thought, well, what are the chances of me being able to get a loan? Of course, I had to jump through special hoops to, you know, make sure I didn't make myself the loan, but, you know, somebody else had to be underwritten, you know, outside of my area. But we were able to get a loan, and just a few short years after closing on our brand new house, new construction, we were able to refinance into the private sector and give somebody else a chance. Yeah.
You not only talk the talk, but you walk the walk. So you yourself and USDA, you know, you utilize the loans. And I believe even Shannon has a similar story where he's helped family members get into USDA loans as well. Correct, Shannon?
Yes, that's correct. Quite a number of them, as a matter of fact. And
very nice.
Yeah. In fact, one family member was able to close a purchase on a home in our county, and because the seller agreed to pay the closing costs as a sales concession allowed in the contract per USDA guidelines, they were able to close on that loan, and their total out-of-pocket expense was $24 for the cost of the credit report.
Yes.
Because the seller gave a 3% sales concession, and that covered everything else.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So pretty cool story.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And hopefully one day when we have an updated podcast regarding USDA, I'll be one of those stories as well.
There you go.
That's the reason why I left the city, is I wanted to look for a property that was a USDA available for USDA. So I'm on that path myself.
Absolutely.
So, Ed, we're kind of winding down on the questions, but I know that you had mentioned earlier in the conversation about contingency reserve. You know, I'm just going to ask it again. because I know this is a hot topic and a hot question. Does the USDA require contingency reserve to be built into the cost of the loan?
No, we do not require it. It is an option, but it is not a requirement. So that's up to the borrower and the lender to make that determination if they want to do that.
And one of the final questions here, are you seeing lenders having trouble getting the appraisal to come in at value, especially when utilizing payment and contingency reserves?
Yeah, it's a good question. We're not hearing about this issue. So I think lenders just need to relay to the appraisers all the costs associated with this loan up front, so they kind of know everything that's going into the loan. I think that's the key to it.
Okay. Well, Shannon, do you have any final questions that you would like to ask Ed before we wrap up today?
The only other thing I would say is manufactured housing, factory built housing has been a big piece of our conversations with clients interested in USDA. And I know you mentioned that they are eligible, but can you further elaborate just a moment? You know, do they have to have HUD seals? Can they be MH Advantage homes? Can they be single wide? Do they have to be double wide? Give us a little more color on that.
Yeah, so we don't really specify a lot of you know, what the house, the physical characteristics of the house. About the only restriction I know of in the regulation that says that a manufactured home can't be less than 400 square feet. So again, that's kind of getting into the tiny home territory. But yes, having the HUD label would be a requirement, you know, to say that it meets the federal manufactured housing safety standards. We don't require it to be a double wide. It could be a single wide. We don't really specify the physical characteristics of those. So one thing I will say is that, you know, over the years we've found a lot of interest in modular homes as well. And a lot of people don't understand the difference in modular and manufactured homes, where modulars are, my understanding is modulars are built in the factory still, but they're built to the building codes as if a site built house was, you know, the same as a site built house is. So different standards there. And that house is then moved from the factory by a, you know, on I-beams out to a site built foundation, and then lifted by a crane over onto that foundation and strapped down. So by the time it's done, it might have a marriage wall, but by the time it's done, you know, it's very hard to differentiate between a site built home and a modular. So the modular homes don't have the HUD labels. It will have a inspection sticker in it somewhere. Each unit will of from their state housing finance agencies in their inspections. So just a little bit about that.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that.
I've always thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
Well, Ed, thank you so much for joining us today. I know that after listening to this podcast, our listeners are going to have more questions about your program and would like to get started. What is the best way to get in touch with you?
Yeah, probably the easiest way is by email. It's a little bit long, but it's initials that stand for Single Family Housing Guaranteed Loan Division. So that's the first letter of each one of those words, sfhgld.lenderpartner@usda.gov. And we also have a toll-free number that's 833-314-0168. And there's five options. And if folks listen to those options, I think they can get where they need to go.
Thank you both again for joining us. Thank you for sharing your knowledge. And thank you all for listening. If you have any questions or feedback to share, please email us at marketing@landguerrilla.com and visit us at landguerrilla.com to learn more about solutions to construction loan management. Again, my name is Jamie Lee, and this is the Construction Lending Podcast.